Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Thank you, Tim. Hello and welcome to the RTC Weekly Download. I am Jim Dolan. Today we'll take a nostalgic stroll down Hollywood Way, back in the old days of Hollywood, to visit with a little behind the scenes for radio and for movies. We'll start off with an episode of Behind the Mic. This is how sound effects are made from 1940.
Radio's own show, Behind the Mic. Radio, with a switch of a dial, radio brings you tragedy, comedy, entertainment, information, education, a whole world at your command. But there are stories behind radio, stories behind your favorite program and favorite personalities and radio people you never hear of. Stories as amusing, dramatic, and as interesting as any make-believe stories you hear on the air. And that's what we give you, the human interest, the glamour, the tragedy, the comedy, and information that are behind the mic. And now, presenting a man whose name, since the beginning of broadcasting, has been a byword in radio, Graham McNamee.
Thank you, Gil Martin, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. This afternoon, Behind the Mic presents the story of how a radio character actor does his stuff, how sound effects are made, the odd story behind the time an announcer was supposed to broadcast from the famous Coconut Grove in Hollywood. We bring you back a few moments of the old Atwater Kent program. And finally, there will be a dramatization of a remarkable story told by Jimmy Wallington. You wouldn't be a radio listener if you didn't wonder, every once in a while, how those sound effects you hear on programs are made. The sound of a taxi, a shotgun, a train wreck, and all the rest of the noises that are necessary to a script. We have two of the best sound effects men in the business here tonight, and they will demonstrate various sound effects and tell you how they're made. Ted Slade will do the actual effects, and Ray Kelly, head of the NBC sound effects department, will explain how each effect is done. Now, Ted, our sound man, has his equipment set up next to a microphone. And I'm going to tell a rather crazy story, which will use many sound effects, and Ray Kelly will explain how each effect was made. Our story begins with our hero's train pulling into the railroad station.
Ladies and gentlemen, that sound was created by using four records, each on a different turntable and all operated by Ted Slade.
Our hero goes to his home and walks up the snow-covered path.
That sound is produced by taking a box of cornstarch and squeezing it in the same rhythm in which a person would walk.
Our hero opens his door.
And that, believe it or not, is a door.
He discovers a burglar, and they have a terrific fight.
And that was accomplished by Ted Slade, the sound man, engaging in a civil war. He punched the open palm of his hand with his fist. He hit himself on the chest, threw several chairs around, broke some fruit baskets, and finally smashed some glass in front of the microphone.
You should have seen that boy beat himself up. Well, our hero now tries to phone the police, but his telephone wires have been cut. So he ties up the burglar and takes him to the police station in his old horse and wagon.
That wagon is a box mounted on casters, which the sound effects man wiggles with his foot. Ted impersonated the horse by taking two rubber plungers and hitting them on his chest. Both the caster box and the plungers are worked simultaneously.
Our hero takes the burglar to jail, where he is safely locked up.
And that sound was done by closing a specially built door constructed exactly like a cell door.
How do you know?
You don't get me on that one. I saw the specification.
And then to give the scene a punch ending and still another sound effect, our hero, wearily enough, feeling pleased with himself, decides to go for a row on the lake.
The lap of the water is created by using a splash box. This is a tank of water with a paddle in it, which is turned slowly to produce the sound of rowing. The squeak of the oarlock was made by using a squeak box, a little gadget that's too complicated to explain here.
And as the moon rises, we leave our hero rowing to his heart's content. Equally pleased that he has captured the burglar and that he has made his first and last appearance on a radio program. Those of you who listen to our program regularly will remember that we have had as guests on Behind the Mic two of the best comedy character actors in radio. Tonight, we have as a guest a different type of actor, a legitimate character actor, a man who plays a large number of different roles, mostly on dramatic shows. He has appeared in Arch Obler's plays, on the Kate Smith Show, and in a great many daytime serials. Tonight, we'd like you to meet him in person. Introducing character actor Gilbert Mack. Gil, what background have you got for character acting?
Well, Graham, I played in stock and I sang in vaudeville and I was even a hillbilly yodeler. As a matter of fact, I broke into radio as a yodeler.
Don't tell me that being a Mountain William helped you to become a radio actor.
Well, as a matter of fact, Graham, I think it did. I'm sure that the flexibility of my voice was helped by my yodeling. I believe that one of the reasons I can play so many characters is because my vocal cords are so elastic.
Oh, so your vocal cords are elastic. You must come around and snap them for us sometime. Well, now that we've got your background stuff, how about showing us some of the characters you actually portray on the air?
All right, Graham. I'll do that in a little sketch in which I'm going to play all the parts.
The scene is the home of the rich Mr. Brownlee. In the spacious living room, a group of people are gathered listening to Mr. Brownlee.
So if you will tell me exactly what you heard and saw last night, we may be able to find some trace of that missing necklace.
Gee, Dad, I was in my room all night.
We're sure of that, Tommy. But did you hear any strange noise?
Well, Grandpa, I got so interested in my ghost story magazine.
Uh-huh. Ghost stories. That ain't for me. I just...
Quiet, Sam. We'll get nowhere unless we stick to facts.
Mr. Brownlee's right, Sam. Suppose we hear from our houseboy, Sato.
Oh, thank you, sir. Last night, about 3 o'clock, I was suddenly aware of presence of strange gentlemen in bedchamber. Then saw a gentleman are putting Sito back to sleep with well-priest tap on head.
And when you awoke this morning, the necklace was gone from the wall safe.
Gee, Dad, this looks like a case for the G-men. Say, look at that car pulling up outside.
Oh.
Say, I wonder who that man coming in there, huh?
Yes, and who's that little fella he's dragging along there with him?
Well, I'm Detective Mannigan from headquarters, and I brought along a suspect. I found him snooping around outside the house.
Well, I know that man. He's Tony, our vegetable dealer.
That's right. I'm just a poor man. I'm selling fruits and vegetables. I'm do nothing, and he said to me I'm a crook.
Doing nothing, is it? Well, then, how come this pearl necklace I found in your pocket?
Yes, sir, that's the jewelry.
Please, Mr. Cop, I'm going to tell you just what happened. When I come here before I ring the bell, Sato, he's opened up the door and pushing his junk in my hand. What am I going to do, eh? So I'm going to hang around and wait when you come along and pull me inside. That's all.
So, Sato gave you that necklace, eh?
Oh, please, sir. Is this a serious mistake?
Never mind the alibis. Come clean or I'll take you down to the station house for questioning.
Oh, please, sir. I am willing to tell the truth if you'll promise not to give me no third-degree copper.
Gee, Dad, Sato lost his accent.
That's right. Sato isn't quite what we thought he was.
Well, I thought I could get away with this disguise till I pulled this job off, but I guess it didn't work out.
But Sato, or whatever your real name is, where did you learn such a neat trick?
That was a cinch. After all, I did a 10-year stretch up in a big house, and I was a star performer every year in the annual show. And it looks like you're going back for return engagement.
Folks, Gilbert Mack not only played every character, but he also made the sound effects of the scream of the automobile brakes.
With my own elastic vocal cords.
And you sure did snap them that time. Thank you, Gilbert Mack. Thank you. Oddities in Radio, presenting odd little true behind-the-mic stories that help make radio sometimes amusing, sometimes exasperating, but always interesting to the people in it. This week's oddity. One of NBC's prominent young announcers is Don Cordray, who appeared on this program a few weeks ago in an interview. Don has an unusual story of, an amusing experience which we thought merited his reappearance. Don, suppose you tell us your story.
All right, Graham. It's going to take us back a few years, but I was an announcer at KFI in Los Angeles. At the time, my burning ambition was to broadcast from the Coconut Grove, where Gus Arnheim was playing at that time.
Why was that such an ambition?
Well, Graham, it may sound silly, but because the Coconut Grove meant getting a chance to meet those movie stars and be seen by them. For a whole year, I ate out my heart and soul just to do one broadcast on a Saturday night for a full hour from Coconut Grove. Well, on a Friday, the chief announcer, Tom Hanlon, called me into his office and said that Freeman Lang, the regular announcer of the Coconut Grove, was ill. I was to fill in for him on that Saturday. Well, Graham, believe it or not, I was so excited at the thought of doing that broadcast, I went out and hired a full dress suit for $12.50. The next night, I was at Coconut Grove, but mind you, plenty early. I saw the engineer as I entered the Grove, and he called me when he saw me come in and said,
Hey, Don, what you doing here so early?
Well, I don't know, Paul, just sort of looking around. Boy, this is some place, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, Don, as long as you aren't doing anything, I wonder if you'd help me out. See that microphone tied up against the wall?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's hanging from the ceiling, and I'm going to untie it so that it'll swing over the center of the stage. Will you catch it for me?
Oh, sure thing.
I'll be careful when it swings over. It's heavy.
Okay.
Here she goes.
Hey, Don!
Who's that? Why, Charlie, what are you...
Hey, look out! It's going to hit you!
Oh!
Come here. Stand back up. Come on, give him some air. Step aside, will you?
Doctor, he's got to do a broadcast tonight.
Broadcast? Not this boy. When that mic hit his head, it knocked him out for the evening.
And I was knocked out, Graham. They called for another announcer. I think it was Ken Carpenter. I never got a chance to broadcast from Coconut Grove.
You poor guy. Socked on the coconut by the coconut. Behind the Mic salutes a program you loved. We in radio believe that radio has a tradition of which it can well be proud. A tradition of good programs that linger fondly in our memory. And so each week, we bring you a star or a part of a program you used to hear. A program you loved. This afternoon, Behind the Mic salutes the old Atwater Kent Hour, which with its national auditions was designed to select the best non-professional singers in the country each year. We recreate part of the Atwater Kent auditions of December 11th, 1927, with the actual winner of the first national competition, the delightful concert soprano Agnes Davis. The Atwater Kent Hour. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. Tonight, Atwater Kent presents the finals of what is probably the most important musical competition ever attempted in the United States. Every singer in the United States under 25 years of age has had an opportunity to be heard. By the process of elimination in local auditions, the contestants have been reduced to 5 young women and 5 young men who have qualified for the national finals. They will sing tonight in the final competition. The Atwater Kent Foundation will award the young woman and young man winning first place $5,000 cash, a gold decoration, and 2 years of musical tuition. The winners of this contest will be selected by a jury of 9 eminent musical authorities. Each singer will be announced by name. The first singer is Miss Mary Sims, who will sing the Caronome. Here, Miss Marie Bronazic of Chicago, who will sing A Forse Lui from Traviata. Our next contestant, Benjamin P. DeLoach, Jr., will sing Drink to Me Only with Thine Eyes. As the last of the 10 contestants, Miss Agnes Davis of Denver will sing Pace, Pace, Mio Dio by Verdi.
Oh, no! vita, ma che giunge qui profanare ardisce il sacro noto. Maledizione, 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 maledizione.
Ladies and gentlemen, the contest which means so much to young singers who traveled so far to take part in the finals of the nationwide search for America's finest and most promising young artists, sponsored by the Atwater Kent Foundation, is ended. The judge's decision will be announced within the next hour, we hope, by the station through which you are listening. This is Graham McNamee saying good evening for the Atwater Kent Hour. Later, when the judges had made their decision, I was happy to announce over the air that Miss Agnes Davis had been adjudged the winner of the first prize for young women singers, $5,000, a 2-year musical scholarship, and a gold medal. Today, Miss Davis, who has appeared as soloist with the leading symphony orchestras throughout the United States, is rated as one of the best concert artists in the country. And as an old friend, Agnes, let me add that after Pache Pache, we need no further proof. Letters from listeners. Each week we invite the listeners of Behind the Mic to write us questions about radio, and the three or four we consider to be of most general interest, we have answered on the air by the radio editor of some outstanding newspaper or magazine. Tonight's questions will be answered by C.J. Ingram, radio editor of the Jersey City Journal, and for 10 years, conductor of his own program, Stardust. Miss Thelma Reed of Boston, Massachusetts, writes in to say, I am a constant listener to Bob Burns' program. I read somewhere that Bob Burns was an expert rifle shot. Is this true, or is it just publicity?
Well, for Miss Reed's information, Bob Burns is really a crack shot. As a matter of fact, he was rifle champion of the AEF and got a gold medal signifying his championship, a medal which was pinned on him by General Pershing himself.
Miss Rose Farrell of Mount Pleasant, Pennsylvania, writes in to ask, since radio is now celebrating its 20th year of broadcasting, can you tell me what was the very first broadcast and what were the call letters of the station that gave the program?
Well, we find there are two schools of thought as to which was the first station to broadcast a regularly scheduled program. The majority of persons in radio seem to think that KDKA in Pittsburgh was the first station to broadcast, and its program was the Harding Cox Election Returns, broadcast November the 2nd, 1920. However, there are some who claim that station WWJ of Detroit broadcast the first regularly scheduled program on August 21st, 1920, when it broadcast the returns of the state primaries.
Miss Marjorie Miller of Birmingham, Alabama writes, I am a frequent listener to the broadcast from the Metropolitan Opera. Can you tell me when was the first broadcast from the Metropolitan Opera House?
In answer to Miss Miller's question, the first broadcast from the Metropolitan was on January 13th, 1910. When an experimental station operated by the DeForest radiophone broadcast the voice of the great Enrico Caruso and Emmy Destin from backstage. The broadcast was picked up at sea by the steamship Avon.
Miss Martha Burnett of New York City asked this question. Can you tell me what was the first program ever to appear on a network?
The first program ever to appear on a network was that given by the Sweethearts of the Air, Peter DeRose and May Singy Breen, on a network consisting of WRC Washington and WEAF New York City. And the broadcast originated in Washington.
Thank you, C.J. Ingram, for answering those questions for us. Thanks a lot. A week or so ago, I was having lunch with a man whose voice must have been heard by every radio listener in the last 10 years. He's been an important cog in many big programs, and right now, he's the announcer on the new Fred Allen Show. Yes, of course, I mean Jimmy Wallington. Jimmy told me a behind-the-mic story I thought was so good and so unusual that I invited him to come here this afternoon to tell you about it. And here he is to do that very thing. But first, I want to welcome him back to the East, Jimmy Wallington. Hello, Jimmy. How are you?
Fine, thank you, Graham. And believe me, it's good to be back with you and my other good friends in New York City. The story starts back in the early 1920s. The scene was the Mojave Desert, way out west in California. An auto was speeding along the dusty highway, and there was a good reason for it to speed, too. In the back seat were a husband and his wife. The wife, in agony, had suddenly been stricken with an attack of acute appendicitis. Their friend, the driver, was getting every last ounce of speed he could from the car in an effort to reach a doctor in the town of Mojave as quickly as possible, when suddenly...
What's the matter?
I don't know. Must be something wrong with the engine. I'll take a look at it.
How are you, dear?
It's pretty bad.
Well, don't worry. We'll get you to a doctor just as soon as we possibly can.
Oh, this is awful. We're out of oil and one of the bearings is shot.
Well, can you fix it?
I'm not here. I'd have to hail a car, explain the situation, and ask them to take her to a doctor. They can't refuse.
Oh, here's one now.
Hey! Hey, stop! Stop! Stop!
I'll try the next one.
This is terrible.
Darling, if there was something I could do. Here comes another one.
Hey, stop! 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 We've had an accident!
Oh, why don't they stop?
I don't know. Maybe they're afraid we're going to hold them up or something. I think there was a holdup along here not long ago.
But we've got to get her to a doctor.
There hasn't been a car along here for half an hour. Well, here's one. This one's got to stop.
Stop! Hey, hey, stop! Stop!
What's the matter?
This lady is sick. We've got to get her to the doctor at Mojave as fast as we can.
We'll be glad to take him, won't we, Dad?
Why, sure thing, son. Come on, get in back, folks, and I'll have you there in a jiffy.
The scene now changes to an Atwater Kent program in 1928. Although you did the actual program announcing Graham, as you know, I also worked on that program. On one Atwater Kent program each year, as you've shown tonight, 10 candidates for musical scholarships and large cash prizes would compete. And some of the foremost people in the musical world would act as judges to select the winner. And also, as you know, the judges did not see the contestants while they were singing, so they could judge them by the voice alone. Contestants and judges met for the first time after the program, when a little party would be held in an adjoining studio. And after this particular program, the evening's winner approached one of the judges who had awarded him the first prize of $5,000.
Oh, pardon me, sir. But may I speak to you a moment?
Why, certainly. I want to congratulate you, young man. You did splendidly.
Oh, thank you, sir. But I want to ask you something. Do you remember a long time ago when you were driving a lady to the doctor and your car broke down in the Mojave Desert? A man came along with his son and they took you to the doctor in their car?
Well, yes, I remember that vividly. Do you mean...
Yes, sir. I was the boy.
Why, of course, now I remember. The father's name was Novus, and you're Donald Novus, his son. This is remarkable.
Yes, sir. But even more remarkable to me is that tonight, for the first time, I should find out that the man we helped was the great Lawrence Tibbett.
Thank you for bringing us a very great story, Jimmy Wallington. Thanks a lot. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions about the inside of radio that you wish answered on the air, write a letter to us. Address it to Graham McNamee, Behind the Mic, National Broadcasting Company, New York City. As many questions as possible will be answered by mail, and those we feel to be of most general interest will be answered on this program. Be sure to listen in next week when we will bring you one of the funniest, most fantastic behind-the-mic stories you ever heard. A story behind Dave Ellman's Hobby Lobby program, as told by Dave Ellman himself. We will also bring you the story of a man who makes a living dying on the radio, and more of the human interest, the glamour, the comedy and the drama that are found behind the mic.
Behind the Mic is written by Mort Lewis, original music composed and conducted by Ernie Watson. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
From 1940, that's Behind the Mic and Sound Effects. Next up, we have What Makes a Star Succeed in Hollywood? Well, we're going to find out right now. This is from 1945.
Bidwell McCormick takes you behind the scenes in Hollywood.
Many times I have wondered, and no doubt you have also, just why some actors and actresses get ahead faster in pictures than others do. Why it is that of perhaps two persons who show great promise, one rises to the height, while another falls to comparative obscurity. What do you think about this, Nathan?
Well, many things enter into the making of a successful career in motion pictures. Sometimes it's an intangible something in his or her personality that makes a star click. More often it's sheer ability, hard work, and a willingness to learn and to keep on learning. And, of course, appearance plays no small part in making of star material.
Yes, I was particularly impressed with the combination of these things not long ago when I was on the set of RKO's forthcoming production, The Spanish Main.
That's being filmed entirely in Technicolor, isn't it? And should make a grand vehicle for lovely Maureen O'Hara.
I agree with you there, Nathan, for I had an opportunity to study this young lady's beauty and charms never before as I was standing on the high platform directly back of the huge Technicolor camera as they were shooting a close-up of her in the Spanish Main. She stood there at the rail of the great sailing vessel, patiently rehearsing and reenacting a scene, her beauty silhouetted against the cloudless sky of studio-painted blue that would defy detection from nature's own, her hair gently tossed in the breeze, and her large, vivid blue eyes sparkling with a rare charm the Technicolor camera will record in all its natural beauty.
Well, there was one answer. Rare combination of charm and beauty, coupled with a willingness to accept hard work under the intense heat of the studio lights, the countless rehearsals, and necessary retakes.
I mentioned a moment ago that a gentle breeze tossed her hair. It is interesting to note how this breeze, in just the right degree of pressure, is brought onto the great sound stage at just the right angle to toss a lock of hair in just the right direction, at just the right instant, to give just the right effect.
I understand that the old use of great bladed fans is taboo on the sound stages, except for hurricanes and the like, because they make too much noise and would interfere with the sound recording, and that an ingenious method of bringing wind onto the stage has been devised.
That's right. The air is brought onto the set under controlled pressure in huge canvas pipes from great fan houses outside the building and directed, not unlike fire hose, by crews especially assigned to the task and trained in their use to fill the sails of a great ship or to gently toss a curl.
Yes, Bidwell, and your mention of fire hose brings to mind how scenes from a motion picture are being used as a fire warden in some 3,000 British factories to impress the workers with the perils of careless cigarette smoking. The British Ministry of Supply arranged through David Griffith, International Pictures representative in London, for a special trailer of Gary Cooper, pointing out the danger of careless cigarette handling. They used actual scenes tied in from Casanova Brown, in which he co-stars with Teresa Wright. A script was cabled to New York's international office, which transmitted its contents by wire to the Hollywood studio. Sequences were shot under personal direction of William Goetz, president of International Pictures, and air expressed back to New York for transshipment by way of special train to London. The British Ministry of Information will supply the special Gary Cooper trailer on Casanova Brian to some 3,000 factories throughout the United Kingdom. And notwithstanding the fact that Britain's already fire-conscious from actual experience, it will be exhibited as an object lesson on fire hazards. And now a word from your local announcer.
And here now are a few production briefs from behind the scenes in Hollywood, presented by Nathan Hale and Manna Ray Ewell.
Dr. Paul Popineau, psychologist and director of the American Institute of Family Relations, has been retained by producer Samuel Goldwyn to give aptitude tests to beauties applying to become Goldwyn girls. Now, the purpose of the test is to distinguish between genuine career girls, potential stars worthy of a Hollywood buildup, and those who may possibly be insincere. Dr. Papineau has devised a written and oral test of 150 questions. Their purpose is to expose a girl's mind in about the same proportions as a musical comedy costume does her figure. Successful candidates will go into the Wonder Man as Goldwyn girls, out of whose ranks in past years emerged Paulette Goddard, Virginia Mayo, Virginia Bruce, Jinx Falkenberg, Betty Grable, and others.
Picking cinematic long shots who unerringly romp to stardom is no trick for director George Sidney. He knows they are literally best by test. In his half-dozen years as a film director, Mr. Sidney has supervised more than 1,000 screen tests, those little publicized showcases which can win or lose a movie contract. By piloting able newcomers through the reefs of these tests, he has launched numberless Hollywood careers, of which Esther Williams is a recent example.
Although she's yet to be seen on the screen, Audrey Young of the Broadway musical comedy stage has been borrowed by RKO from Paramount for one of the leading roles in George White's Scandals of 1945. Miss Young recently completed her first screen role in Paramount's Out of This World with Eddie Bracken, Veronica Lake, and Diana Lynn. Her singing and dancing talents will get full scope in Scandals, which co-stars Joan Davis and Jack Haley.
According to Dr. Jeffrey Grace, medical advisor to the Master Hairdressers Association of Southern California, a head of perfect hair occurs only about once in 3 million humans, and screen star Virginia Mayo is the possessor of this unusual distinction.
Drew Pearson, syndicate writer and radio commentator, will make his film debut in the picture Betrayal from the East. He appears in the prologue and does the narration. Lee Tracy and Nancy Kelly are co-starred in the picture, which is based on Alan Hines' novel.
30 recordings of Latin American folk songs will be used as background music for The Magnificent Tramp, the working title for the Hollywood film to star Mexico's idol, Cantinflas. It will be brought back to the film capital by Konstantin Bakalynikov, head of the studio's music department, who spent a month of research for this picture in Mexico City.
William Powell, the only actor who has portrayed the late great Florence Ziegfeld on the screen, will again be seen in the role of the mighty showman, this time in Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's star-studded Technicolor musical review, Ziegfeld Follies. Powell played Ziegfeld in the Academy Award winner, The Great Ziegfeld, also made by MGM a few years back. In addition to Powell, the picture's lineup now includes Fred Astaire, Edward Arnold, Lucille Ball, Jimmy Durante, Judy Garland, Red Skelton, Esther Williams, and many others, including the glorified Ziegfeld girls.
Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer announced recently that Anne Southern, following her role in The Harvey Girls, will be back in her favorite characterization of the hard-boiled Brooklyn blonde in a new Maisie picture, Up Goes Maisie, to be produced by George Haight.
Folks, would you like to have a postcard picture of a movie star's home? Well, just drop a card asking for it to Bidwell McCormick in care of this station. And now a word from your local announcer.
We have a couple of personality close-ups of famous stars for today's broadcast of Behind the Scenes in Hollywood.
If one had to describe Dick Powell in a single word, I think the best word to use would be friendly. He's genuinely friendly, not ostentatiously democratic. He never backslaps or deliberately courts the humbler members of a movie troupe, but he does show a definite interest in them, their work, and their problems. For 12 years, Hollywood cast him in juvenile singing roles until he got so sick of them he took himself off the screen for 2 years and devoted himself to business, and very successfully, too. He dreamed of getting good, dramatic, tough roles, something he could get his teeth into, and for which he's physically well-equipped, having a fiercely sprouting beard which he has to shave twice a day, a nose which has been broken and cheekbones thickened from much boxing and football. His part in RKO Radio's Murder My Sweet, in which he's co-starred with Claire Trevor and Anne Shirley, is just what he's been looking for. He plays a very tough, though human, private detective, and for the first time in his career, he wears no makeup. He has a good earthy sense of humor, but hates puns. He has a fund of good stories and is an accomplished raconteur, but he backs away from off-color stuff. He sings snatches of songs as he goes about his daily chores, but won't do any real singing unless it's demanded of him. He and John Charles Thomas are good friends and have jam sessions in which he teaches Thomas to swing it, and Thomas tries to initiate Dick into the mysteries of grand opera. The servant shortage hasn't dismayed him as much as some people. He's really a very versatile fellow, this Dick Powell. He can do anything there is to be done about the house. He's an expert furniture repairer and polisher, and boasts he can make anything from a boat to a pair of shoes, including skinning the critter and tanning the leather. He repairs his own automobiles and won't let anyone else do any house repairs. Any friends who drop in during the weekend are put to work doing something useful, and a certain big executive could have been seen recently digging holes for rose bushes. He's religious in an unobtrusive sort of way, and credits his whole career to his start as a singer in Little Rock, Arkansas church choirs. He's a big booster for his home state and also for California, and he has some praise left over for Louisville, Kentucky, where he started his professional singing career, and Pittsburgh, where fame as a radio singer and master of ceremonies caught up with him. That's the story of Dick Powell. And now, Manna Ray, you tell us about Claire Trevor.
Well, Hollywood people, including some famous directors, have called Claire Trevor one of the truly great actresses on the screen today and are given to wonder why she hasn't attained even greater fame. Claire's reply is to the effect that she's lazy. However, her friends know better. When she's working at her job, she gives all she has. But it is true that she hasn't that fierce concentration on her career that marks some stars. Whenever her career is likely to interfere with her married life with Lieutenant Silas Williams Dunmore, it's her career that has to take a back seat. She turned down one of her most important roles to go honeymooning. The trite way to publicize a screen tough guy is to paint him as a gentle soul who can't bear to swat a fly, and to paint a screen bad girl as a sweet little homebody in real life. Claire is a stickler for facts, so at the risk of being thought trite, she admits that she's a good housekeeper, lives in a cottage, and enjoys looking after her home. Most of the bad girls she plays have hearts of gold, but in RKO Radio's Murder My Sweet, in which she is co-starred with Dick Powell and Dan Shirley, it's doubtful if she has any heart at all, and she hasn't any redeeming feature. But it's a colorful role, and there's never a dull moment in any of her scenes. Claire is fond of tennis, golf, and swimming, reads everything from classical novels to paperback mysteries. She collects perfumes in Dresden, China, and has a strong partiality for lobster Newburg and hot hors d'oeuvre. She will have nothing to do with spinach, puddings, or squash. She would like to be a good cook and tries hard, but she just hasn't got the knack for it. One of the joys of her life is a black cocker named Little Joe. Seeing her own pictures, even the best of them, depresses her. She sees so many spots where she thinks she could have done better. However, she's an avid moviegoer and closely studies the work of other stars. She's easy to get along with, and on first meeting, she manages to get a warmth into a greeting, which convinces the recipient that she is genuinely delighted to meet him. Claire Trevor lives in Beverly Hills, where much of her time is taken up in bringing up 6 months old Charles Dunsmore.
Listen in again next week when Bidwell McCormick takes you behind the scenes in Hollywood.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.